All right, hello and good morning.
Morning.
Good morning.
All right. So, how is your week?
It's going.
So I'm going to get some things ready for us to look at here. Hope you all are well. I look forward to the weekend as much as you do, I think. So almost there. For today, want to, before we continue with the machine level data structures, I wanted to just review the little introduction or the slides on pointers, which I believe we actually had around the time of Bomb Lab. So yes, my calendar says February 14th, Valentine's Day. So I'm going to call those slides up again, and we'll take a look, especially what we're talking about. Standby. I think I mentioned last time, but please do come back and see us during is not what's happening this semester. So we've come up with some other stuff for you to do, and you're going to have some options. So you'll have some amount of questions to answer like before, but there'll also be some choices where you can either write some code and do some more programming, or you can do some writing to answer some things. So you will have some choices between submit words, but either way, we will be using Autolab to collect your submissions for your final exam instead of paper. So stay tuned next week. We'll have a lot to say about that. And so now let's let us resume. I'll do this little pointer review as soon as I can get the slides up. Okay. So this is what we looked at before about pointers. So so this came up again when we started discussing data structures at the low machine level. And remember, on Wednesday, we talked about arrays for probably a lot more than you thought we would. For arrays, a pretty simple idea in our computing, but we looked at them in great detail and the differences between addresses and values, or between pointers and values. So pointers, just the syntax of it in C looks like this. So we can have an int x, that's a regular int with some value. In this case, the number 99 is chosen. But we can also have p, which is of type int pointer, or pointer to an int. And p will store an address of a value. And from your experience in GD. The ampersand here is the represents address of X. So every int not only has can store value, but will also be a have an address. So and is like within a within a certain function, then that 99 would be stored in stack memory for that particular instance of that function. If it was outside of a function as a global X equals 99, then it would instead be in the data section of the executable program or heap memory, but slightly separate from the stack memory. Either way, there's an address of every byte of memory, and that's where that 99 is. So let's illustrate that a little bit here. So we have this little diagram of computer memory, and this is, you know, intending to illustrate this idea that our memory space is essentially linear from, you know, starting with byte zero to byte large. But of course, you know now that we use virtual memory addresses and they get translated into real memory addresses. In any case, as far as the program's concerned, the virtual memory address is the memory address. So X lives at some place in memory. And let's see, can I even illustrate with this? I don't know if I have the right tools for that. But you can see the 99 in memory here. So it has some address. We're going to say M1, we're going to use as a placeholder for, you know, the big hexadecimal number that GDB would tell us for this location in memory. So X equals 99, but also X has there's an address of X, this ampersand X. Well, what is that address? M1, the thing that we're using to represent that memory address. So we have 99, the value, and M1, the address. So we can reference this 99 by just saying, you know, we could print or add or subtract from this value X, but we could also say star P, because we could take P, which is an address, and putting a star in front of it when using it throughout the program says dereference it and access the value there. Up here is a declaration, the star says this is a pointer, but down here in use it says dereference the pointer. Now P itself is still stored somewhere. Again, if this was within a function, this would all be in the stack memory for that function. So P would have to store that address, in which M1 is what the address is, but that would go somewhere else in memory. That place itself would also have a those bytes of memory also have addresses. So M2 is where M1 was stored. So that's you can have another layer of indirection. You say, well, what's the address of P? If P is storing an address, then it itself must have an address, which we'll represent with M2 here. P can be dereferenced with a star in front of it, and we can also get the address of P by putting the ampersand in front of it. So these are just the different ways that we can go from value 99 to its address. Address of X, or which we'll call M1, and then we can go back from an address to a value by putting the star in front of it. Now, what do we have here on the right? What would this mean? A star in front of X. What do you think? Well, if we're going to be totally literal about it, I mean, we know the star says dereference this. Well, dereference what? Dereference 99. Well, what is 99? Well, if 99 were a valid memory address, then dereferencing it would just give you whatever is there. In this case, we have these X's here because in this case, 99 is almost surely not a valid memory address, and we would get some sort of segmentation fault if we were to try and dereference it, which is why when you're dealing with pointers or even just arrays, because we found out arrays are made of pointers, when you're dealing with pointers and arrays in C and you have too many dereferences or other problems with dereferencing, often segmentation fault occurs when you have this type of error. Did we look at this before in class? Is this familiar? I don't remember how much of this we got. I just saw the chat. Max says interprets X as memory address. Yeah, which that is correct. So, okay, so that is just one illustration. You can see the source for that if you want to. But the real kind of authoritative source on this notation, of course, is the KNR book on C, Kernighan and Ritchie's book on C, the first and authoritative publication. And so they give this example in their chapter 5 of an int X with 1 in it, an int Y with 2 in it, and then an array of 10 ints called Z, or starting with Z. And then also a pointer called IP for int pointer. The definition here is int star. So, and these comments are given here. IP is a pointer to some int, and then down here it is set to address of X. So now IP contains the address of X, so it points to X. And so if you take IP and dereference it, you get the value from that location. So Y is not the address of X, Y is whatever X was, which is 1. So now that 2 in Y has been overwritten with a 1. And again, keep in mind this thing up on top, the star means, in the definition, it means this is a pointer. And down here, the star means take that pointer and dereference it. So here, the dereference can also occur on the left side of the expression. So IP, which again is a pointer, if it's a valid memory address, you dereference it and then write to it. The value 0 is placed at that address in memory, which of course, you know, that is the address of X. So now that 1 in X has been overwritten with a 0. And then finally, this thing IP, well, it could now point at a different place in memory, such as Z of 0. So the first entry in the Z array, of course, it could point at Z of 2, which would just be some distance after Z. So these are different operations using the pointer notation. Like I said, when we were looking at arrays on Wednesday, these operators came up again. So I wanted to just give you a little refresher. Okay. And then, so I have three different ways of illustrating basically the same stuff. The last one comes from our friends at CS Illustrated, who drew it up nicely. I love the little aliens representing P, Q, and X. In this case, P is of type pointer, Q is of type int pointer, and X is just a regular int. You are allowed to declare them all in one line like this, with two of them as pointers and one as a value. I think it's a little unnecessary to do it all in one line. I like to be very clear that what's a pointer and what isn't. But in any case, P and Q are of type pointers. They can reference a memory address. Of course, when they're first initialized, they don't have anything. And just like X also has no value. So these are just these dangling arrows. These are, and dangling is actually the term for pointers that don't point at anything. Pointers hold addresses, and arrays are contiguous sets of values. So we can also have an array of 4 ints, and the name A just points at the beginning of that array. Because again, yesterday, remember we saw that arrays are just made of pointers, and we can tell when we disassemble a program and look at what the assembly does. It's really just using pointers to get in this array. So the little alien A points at the beginning of these 4 ints. And now, since we've initialized all these things without putting any values in them, note that each of the little green guys has a little garbage can, which is referencing, well, there's nothing there yet. It could be the remains of what was there before in memory. In any case, when we do start writing values to places in memory, we will see the trash can replaced with the values we want there. So, what do you think so far? Overly cute or awesome? Hopefully both. So, when we start operating with these things, again, the C code here is on the right. So saying, okay, so this first line here, and we haven't really discussed malloc a whole lot, but this is saying P, which is a pointer. Well, we're going to point it to some address. And in addition to existing stuff like X, we can also request from the system additional memory to store things in. So that's what the malloc calls for, memory allocate size of end 4 bytes. So it's basically saying, want 4 bytes free to use. And then this is casting into type end pointer. This is really C's way of allocating manually. We haven't made you guys do a lot of this. Although if you looked very closely at IntroLab, you may have seen use of this. Although this is roughly equivalent to the new statement in Java, where it's, you know, creating a new object. So this is creating a pointer P, and in this, you know, malloc is a system call, so it's actually, you know, asking the operating system to intervene and allocate memory. Has returned with 40, which is of course a fake small address, but we're saying 40 is now the address that P will have. So if you look, points to 40, meaning the little green guy has the number 40 written on him. That's what's in box 12, the value 40. Looks a little messy, but that's the explanation. Line 2 looks up the address of X and stores it in Q. So that's what we were familiar with seeing before. Address of X equals Q. So X has some address, 20. Well, Q now holds 20. So that's the arrow pointing. So X and also pointer to some other space over at address 40. If we go on now accessing these things, we can actually set values here. So if you take P, which again is it's over here at location 12, but it contains an address 40. So we're saying dereference P equals 1. So, you know, if it was just P equals 1, then the, you know, the value 1 would be stuck at P, which is right here, which of course maybe 1's not a memory address, but we wouldn't find out until we try and dereference it later. But no, we're not writing 1 into P. We're saying, look at P, there's a memory address there, dereference it, and write the 1 at the other end of the arrow, at the other end of the pointer. So P contains 40, dereference it, look at that address 40 and put the 1 there. There's our happy green guy with now the value 1. Q can be dereferenced. Again, taking Q's value is 20, which is a memory address here. The other end of that arrow is location 20, and now the number 2 gets written there. We have happy happy green guy here. And finally, 3 is written to, well, the wherever A points to, which is the beginning of the array, address 24 here. And I think we saw yesterday, well, on Wednesday, that A of 1 would be, you know, adding 4 bytes, since we know it's an array of ints. A of 1 would see add 4 bytes to A. A is a pointer 24, so add 4 bytes, we now have 28. And so A of 1, we would write the value there. A of 2 would go to 32. We can use square in parentheses dereferenced. We saw on Wednesday two different ways of doing arrays. We're used to the square brackets, far more convenient and readable. But really, the square brackets notation just gets turned into pointer arithmetic and pointer dereferencing. So pointers all the way down, as we saw on Wednesday. These values P, address of P, P, and dereferenced P, I read them backwards, P dereferenced, P itself, and address of P could all be printed in a C program. Q dereferenced, Q, and address of Q could all be printed out, and A dereferenced A and address of A can all be printed out. This example was using the old 32-bit values of, you know, from 32-bit programs where pointers were simply 4 bytes. Also, these numbers, 24, et cetera, are kind of low. But they fit on the slide nicely. So thanks to CS Illustrated, we have some nice colorful pictures of pointers. So that's our pointer review. I don't remember if we spent a lot of time on it before, but it's worth reviewing because pointers is considered one of the finer of C programming. And as you may have found out during Shell Lab, even if you don't writing code dealing with a lot of pointers and memory addresses, that can happen. And a lot of times in DobyGFG, when you're dealing with matching strings and characters, and when you have one too many array dereferences or array accesses or one too many pointer dereferences, suddenly, boom, you have a segmentation fault. And I think a lot of people find that very frustrating. But if you understand more about, you know, what pointers are and that array are made of pointers, you can make more sense of it. And when GDB says segmentation fault here, you can, you know, you can find out, well, what was it accessing and make sense of it and fix it. So any thoughts on that? Did we talk about swapping some values X and Y? Also an example from the classic KNR text. So have you seen this problem? Kind of a classic problem, and a way that people often like to discern if you are a like novice programmer or if you are you know, experienced in computer science and computing. So not surprising to see this in some sort of like interview question or something for those of you who are interested in you know, interviewing well in the future. So you might look at this code on the right and say, okay, A is 123, B is 456. We have the swap thing. We're going to swap A and B. So wouldn't be crazy to think, wouldn't be weird to look at this and say, okay, yeah, great. Takes X, puts it in temp, puts Y where X is, puts temp and Y. Great, we swapped these things. Wouldn't blame you for thinking that at first. But if we look more at how our programming language works and how this gets turned into real instructions for the processor when it gets compiled, this won't result in A being 456 and B being 123, because when swap is called, these values, 123 and 456, are simply copied into X and Y, and then swap makes these changes. X and Y are part of the scope of swap, and this thing temp is a stack variable for the swap function call. And when this thing returns, which is implied at the end since it's of type void, you know, X and Y go away and A and B remain unchanged. This is called call by value, which is how swap is called. So it's not actually modifying A and B, it's modifying X and Y, which are copies of A and B. So we can make a swap function that does operate on the addresses of the things, of the arguments given to it. So in this case, if you wrote a different function that deals with pointers instead of values, now X, P, and Y, P are both pointers. They're not copies of 123 and 456, but in fact, address of A, wherever A is in memory, storing that 123, and address of B. So now swap is being told, here's an address of one thing, here's an address of another thing, swap them. So the swap function now knows, well, if this is an address, dereference it and store the value here. If YP is an address, dereference it and store the value there. Now T1 can be stored where X is pointing to, dereference it, and T0 can go to where Y is pointing to. And this will result in, after this call, A will contain 456 and B will contain 123. When this is compiled into assembly, it actually is nice in that we see exactly one assembly instruction for each line of C code here. And we can illustrate this nicely. We have actually kind of both renderings of assembly here, but you're used to the one on top. So we have a nice diagram of this. So we can go through each like line of this assembly and illustrate it. Did we do this before in the earlier in the semester? You can stop me.
I think
you don't think so?
No.
Okay, great. Well, then let's illustrate because this is useful. So when, you know, again, imagine we're in GDB and stepping one line of assembly at a time. If RDI and RSI contain these two addresses, and again, these are like low made up addresses. But if we have these addresses 120 and 100, and each of those addresses contains those values 123 and 456, right? So these are the parameters to, and we'll go back to C code, swap our address of X of Y. So the address of one of them will be 120. That'll be the address of X, first parameter in the calling convention, RDI, and RSI contains second parameter address 100. So when it comes time to do these moves, first instruction says, go to RDI and dereference it, because we know it's an address. So look up at, if RDI has 120 in it, go to address 120 and find the value there. So we're not putting 120 in REX, we're putting the value 123 in REX. So again, difference between, you know, you could move RDI to REX and you would just copy that memory address, that 120. But this is dereferencing it with keyword pointer, keyword meaning 8 bytes for we use these days. We tend to represent memory addresses in hexadecimal and this other stuff in decimal, but really you can print it either way, and you've seen GDB will let you print it in whatever format you want. So next line of assembly, similar thing, look at the address of RSI, dereference it, find the thing at that location and put it in RDX. So two addresses dereferenced and had their things moved into registers temporarily. So now these two values in registers, we can move them to any location in memory. Again, taking RDX, the thing in this bottom register here in red, that can get taken and moved to some address in memory. Well, what address? Take RDI and dereference it. So RDI has address 120, go to that location there, 456 gets written there. And then the same thing here, the 123 gets written to whatever address RSI points to. So, you know, in C, this is written as, you know, star XP and star YP as the dereferences. In assembly, that just turns into this keyword pointer square brackets thing. So hopefully your experience in assembly and now in C helps you connect these things. So that's our pointer review. What do you think? If you don't have thoughts on that, we will finish talking about our data structures in memory, which is where we left off before. Are you ready? Let's get that back. So these slides, and once again, I will remind you that we're doing course evaluations now. Please do it for this and all of your courses. So we talked a whole bunch about arrays and different ways of writing them, different ways of accessing them, like all this. Where did we leave off? I think we left off right around. We looked at some assembly accessing an array with the base RDI or base Z and index digit times 4 because of 4-byte ints. And we have this loop going through and dereferencing and incrementing stuff. So I think we left off around here. Is that right? So multi-dimensional nested arrays. So again, remember we had this generic declaration before, some type T, some identifier A, and now we have two indices, two numbers in square brackets, R and C, which we would call rows and columns. So if we're calling this a two-dimensional array, I think you're used to doing this sort of thing in Java. So type elements of type T, you know, for some number of rows and columns, and we can imagine this like in the upper right here with A of 0, 0 in the upper left. And then proceeding over columns this way to A of 0 of however many columns, minus, so that A, and so the row is the first and column is. And of course, from mathematics, we're used to this idea of matrices, two-dimensional array, kind of looks like that. Of course, people do this to me. Of course, they do this to me. the size of the array is a pretty easy multiplication problem. Rows times columns times how many bytes per data type T. So again, 4 bytes for ints. And then we're going to talk about how these are arranged, because our memory is not actually two-dimensional, even if we have this idea that our array is a two-dimensional idea. Really, our memory is this one-dimensional linear space of addresses. So, and again, we've kind of come back to this several times throughout the semester. So we have this two-dimensional array really gets laid out in memory in one straight line. And this is the ordering for this is called row major, in which each row, so A of 0 of 0, A of 0 of 1, all of the A of 0 numbers incrementing the last number in the array index, the C, they all get laid out in order. And then we go to the next row in each of the columns in that row. So row 0 is all in red here. Row 1 is in yellow. And however many more rows, the last row is in green, and each column is next to each other. So called row major ordering. I think we mentioned that before, but this is the rule for C. And in fact, really, pretty much anything you're going to see in computer science will work this way. I went and dug up this diagram just to sort of further illustrate. Row major ordering follows this red line here. If we have this matrix of this sort, it doesn't have to be square, but it is in this example. And then the opposite of row major ordering would be column major ordering, which is what we see with the thing on the right. So in C and in Java and in pretty much anything in computer science, you will see row major ordering. Column major ordering does exist. It exists in some languages such as Fortran, MATLAB, and R. I don't know if you all are familiar with these. These are generally used not in computer science, but like, for example, R is designed by and used by statisticians, and in their world, column major ordering is the way. MATLAB is also often used in mathematics and science, as is Fortran. In their world, column major ordering is the way. But also in their world, arrays and matrices, the first index is 1 and not 0. So in that sense, you know, they just do things differently. And but that's not the direction computer science has gone in. And people can debate for eternities whether the, you know, index should start at 0 or start at 1, or if we should go row major or column major. But computer science, we're doing it row major, and we're starting at 0, and we're sticking with that. And so if you love column major and you love starting at 1 instead of at 0, the, you know, statisticians will warmly welcome you into their midst, and you can learn the programming language R, which I think looks quite strange to computer scientists, but makes total sense to statisticians. These are arbitrary choices. I think your life is better when you stick with one. We'll be using the system on the left here. Have you like seen both of these or debated which is the right way to do these things like indexes?
I mean, rows just make more sense.
Ah, spoken like a true computer scientist. So engineers use 0. I'll take your word for that. I don't know. I guess they're with us then. I mean, there are certainly people who dabble in both fields. Dr. Hawk loves MATLAB, for example, and it's good at computing stuff. So yeah, I like Rome Major also. I mean, on the other hand, most of us probably grew up counting starting at one, right? Understandable that you might like it that way. But you can just see how like much more sense it makes to start at zero, because then like, let me just, where was that? You know, if X is, you know, if the array starts at X, like, well, you have to store a value at X. Like, you know, if we would have to, you know, if you say X plus one is some, you know, if the array index one is X plus something, then what are we just, right? Like, you're doing these pointer computations, like starting zero makes way more sense. Otherwise you'd have to like shift everything or waste 4 bytes or something like that. So yeah, the starting zero actually has, there's good reasons for that.
Bless you.
Okay, so because we have row major ordering. Was as entities of this, we have 4 different sets of 5 numbers. So in this case, PGH is an array of 4 things. Well, each of those things is itself an array of 5 numbers. So zipdig PGH of 4 is equivalent to int of, because that's what the zipdig thing was declared as. So there are, PGH is an array of 4 elements, but each of those elements has 5 ints in it. So 15206 would be the first array of 5 things stored in memory, each taking up 4 bytes. Of course, this is, you know, an inefficient way to store so many low numbers. These could all be big numbers, but again, this is our nice, you know, small example we can illustrate and look at on this slide. So this is how this would be laid out in memory, even though we can consider, like, you know, like all those ones being in some sort of column vertically, you'd have to do these jumps from 76 to 96 to 116 to go down the columns. But to go across, we're making these small little 4-byte moves. And of course, this came up a lot when we were looking at caching, because when you fetch the one here, thanks to our spatial locality, we get better performance when going linearly from 15206 rather than 11115555. So we've seen this example several times now. Hopefully the colors are a little bit useful for you here. Each of these bits can be considered its own array. So A of 0 is an array of 5 things, A of 1 is an array of 5 things, etc., and they're all right next to each other. So again, we can see this pulled apart when we compile some code and see what the assembly looks like, because again, we don't really have arrays in assembly, we just have pointers. So all of this array stuff gets turned into pointers. So if we are going to access one of these indices from within the PGH thing, remember each thing in PGH is itself an array, but if you want to grab the first one, so you know, PGH of 0 would be this 15206, PGH of 1 would be 15213. If RDI is the index here, well, okay, so let's read this assembly. First, we have an LEA, so it's doing some calculation. Of course, it's, LEA is supposed to do array addresses, so this is cool. So RDI plus RDI times 4. What? Remember, these things are confusing to read. That's RDI times 5. Why didn't it just say RDI times 5? And then why RDI times 5? Well, there's 5 ints in every one of these arrays. So if we're going for index of 1, well, we need to skip 5 more before it. But not only are we skipping 5 you know, numbers within that array, but each of those numbers takes up 4 bytes. So If we're talking about index one, well, we multiply by 5, but then 5 times 4 is 20, and that's how many bytes we have to move up to get to here. Because remember, 76 to 96, that number 20 is just added to, and then the assembler says offset flat. But really, in GD, this is going to be a number, you know, in hexadecimal 400 something. After this thing, PGH. PGH is the beginning. The array name is the beginning address, 76 in this case. Add 20 to it, boom, you're right here at the yellow part. So they just 20 times the index, but of course, they do do these two LEAs. Why would you do it that way, though? Why not just to multiply by 20? What's so special about 4? Did I hear someone? Thought I heard something, but I didn't catch it. You know, 4 is a power of 2. A left shift will do this very very quickly. So, man, compiler just loves multiplying by 4. So, now that is about grabbing the beginning of a whole array here. So we can also say, well, what if we want to get just a specific element within that array? So not just A of I, but A of I of J. So that involves more computation. But in this case, it's going to involve getting a specific digit. So. I think we got some noise here. Can one of the TAs find out who needs to be muted? Thank you. So grab a specific digit. There's two computations here, finding, the multiply by 5, but then also, by 4, and there's two, that number gets computed, added, and dereferenced, boom. So, you know, you could say plus 20 and then plus, 20 times the index, and then which digit, we can grab, you know, 1 and 1 would be this 5 here, 20 plus 4, 24 bytes in, 1 and 2 would be this 1, et cetera. So you can follow that. The one other example that's here is actually, rather than having an array of arrays, we could also have an array of pointers. So that would say pointers to int arrays. An array of int pointers, actually, I'm sorry. So 3 different pointers could be to these 3 sets, these 3 arrays of numbers. So in this case, U and IV would hold 3 pointers, and they could be in any order, really, an address of that array, an address of that array, an address of that array. So a little bit different because they're not all necessarily all in some order or next to each other. It gives some more flexibility, but it does actually require 2 different pointer dereferences to find the digit needed. So we can find that out when compiling. So that's a little bit more memory work, but also gives more flexibility. We won't spend a ton of time digging into that, but these two bits of code that do something very similar have somewhat different ways of computing that. Anyway, that's what we have in these multidimensional arrays. The final thing I want to get to talking about data types is heterogeneous data types, which is to say structures. So we don't all have to deal with arrays of the same data type int, but we can do structures combining, say, ints and pointers or characters or all these different things. We could have some two-dimensional arrays and also some plain numbers. This is sort of becoming more like objects that you're familiar with, although objects also have methods. These are just values together, or even pointers. But structs can be all together in memory of different types, and they're ordered in a way specified in the code, and the compiler will figure out how to lay them out in memory. So the reason we show this is just the way these things get organized. Structs are quite common. Of course, you've seen objects are common, and storing a group of things together of different types. For example, a record about a student, which you did in Intro Lab, all sorts of other things. It's very common to have mixed data types and structs or how that's done in C. So we can see that A is 4 ints, so that's going to be 16 bytes, followed by this value I, which is size T, really is the size of a memory address, which is 8 bytes on x86-64. And then finally, another a pointer to next, which is another 8 bytes, taking us up to 32. And you know, this would be an implementation of a linked list with this next pointer at the end. We can get elements of this thing A in a similar way using its index and the size of the element. And when following linked lists, this involves just a memory dereference, and we have a disassembly of that. We won't go too far into that now. But what we do want to talk about is the way that this data gets stored. There are rules about how data are organized within structures and called alignment rules. So data is aligned in certain locations, and this might seem totally like arbitrary and weird to make up all these rules, but there's actually a good reason, and that all comes back to caching and performance, which we discussed a few weeks ago. So for caching purposes, the compiler wants to get the fastest access to these members of the struct and wants them to line up on certain memory boundaries so that cache blocks hold the entire element and not just parts of it. So the rule is that the address of an int must start on some multiple of 4 because ints are of size 4. A value of type double is 8 bytes, and so V must start on a multiple of 8. So it has to do with addresses being a multiple of the size of the data type. So, and this is motivated by cache performance and the virtual memory system. So we want to minimize cache misses, and we want to minimize page faults, both of which we've talked about briefly, and you'll go into more in your operating systems class. But the compiler handles this. What it comes down to is this: characters are 1 byte. Every byte is a multiple of 1, of course. A short int would need to be on a multiple of 2. An int would need to be on a multiple of 4. Conveniently, our memory addresses are such that masking makes this easy by saying, well, it's just the, for a 2 byte, if something has to be on a 2 byte multiple, you can just zero out the last bit of the address or the last 2 bits if you needed to be on a multiple of 4. That's kind of scratching the surface of the alignment rules. There's a little bit more here when it involves when you have arrays of structs. So the whole struct also must be on some multiple of the largest element in struct. This all comes up when you are figuring out how much space things really take up. You can change the ordering of things to make them take up less space, because these alignment rules result in some padding, which can be somewhat wasteful of space. So if you change the order, there's like more efficient ways to pack these things. That's a very quick look at structs. In past semester, we've done a little written activity on this, I don't have a way to give you papers right now, but we'll see if we can, we might be able to give you something in Autolab to mess with structs a little bit. But next week, we're also going to give you a bunch of stuff about how to get your final exam work into us. We're going to start telling you about it next week so that you have plenty of time. Our normal exam date would have been in May, which I guess is what, in about 2 weeks. But we want you to get you started next week rather than waiting till May, so you can work on a few different things. You'll have a choice between writing some code or writing some English text for us to read. Either way, you'll show that you know about You've learned some stuff about caching and memory systems. You've learned some stuff about buffer overflows and security. And of course, the all-important shell lab. So that's what we're getting with next week. We have a whole bunch of little challenge questions about pointers and arrays at the end of the slide set that you can check out and test your brain. So I'm interested to take questions and chat with you guys any time you have left today. And if not today, then we will next talk on Monday. Once again, don't miss it. You want to know what your final exam worth 100 points, how you'll get those 100 points should be of interest to you. So we will talk about that next week, starting Monday. And I hope you're all well, have a good weekend, are doing well in the rest of your classes, and of course are doing your course evaluations. There you go. I'll end on that.